Hello, welcome to the Sleep to Healthy. I'm your instructor, Dennis Trumpy, and this is lesson number 2 of the Sleep to Healthy How to Cure Insomnia class. This lesson is titled Sleep and You. In this lesson, you will learn the basics about sleep and insomnia that will set the foundation for the rest of this course. I will be teaching only what's needed for you to successfully complete this course and improve your sleep, and I will ignore all the non-essential sleep and insomnia trivia. I'll begin with sleep basics, so we have a common language and understanding of terms. So, what is sleep anyway? Although you sleep daily, you may not have been told what sleep is. Scientists are still trying to unravel the mysteries of sleep, but as a starting definition, sleep is a mental and physical state that has distinct differences from your waking state. So, regarding your interaction with the environment, during wakefulness, you're geared to react to the world around you through your senses. A slight touch on your arm by a stranger triggers a reaction of withdrawal. Your name spoken softly on the other side of the room catches your ear. But when asleep, even if you're touched, you're much less likely to notice it or react to it, other than perhaps to move your position to get a little more comfortable. So sleep is a partial isolation or withdrawing from the environment. In terms of your brain's thinking processes, when awake, your brain is in control. You observe what's happening around you. You decide what it means and you react. When asleep, you're either dreaming and in a fantasy world or simply resting. So in sleep, your thoughts are aimed inwards rather than outwards. In summary, sleep is an alternative mental and physical state that is inward focused rather than outward focused. But that doesn't mean that sleep is a passive activity. In a coma or when you're put under for an operation, the brain is basically inactive. But in sleep, there's a lot going on. Sleep is mainly an activity that benefits the brain. Physical benefits are less critical. Michael Schwartz, who is an expert in measuring sleep in the laboratory, puts it this way.
So I think it's really helpful to first understand that sleep is not a uniform state. It feels like it at night. It feels like either you're asleep or you're awake. But there's a tremendous amount of things going on while we sleep. It's very complex. All the brain chemistry changes and physiological changes that happen while we sleep are just profound. And really every organ in your body, every physiological system is all different while you sleep compared to while you're awake.
There are important benefits that you get from sleep. For instance,
7.
Important memories are reinforced and unimportant memories are let go. This means that you learn better and remember more.
6.
Emotions are processed to help you make sense of the world, so you become more emotionally balanced and in control.
5.
You learn complex tasks and motor skills. They're reinforced while you're sleeping. So, for instance, you'll learn athletic skills or crafts more quickly.
4.
Growth hormones are released, either to grow or to heal your body.
3.
Appetite hormones are regulated to make it easier to eat healthily and control your weight.
2.
The brain spends time rejuvenating and flushing itself of waste products to ready itself for another day of activity.
1.
And of course, it helps you to feel good, refreshed, and alert when you are awake. So your relationships with others improve and you just feel better. The point here isn't to memorize or worry about not getting these specific benefits because of your insomnia, but just to know that anything you do to improve your sleep is going to benefit you in a way that you will notice and appreciate. It's also helpful to keep the benefits of sleep in perspective and not get unduly worried or focused about sleep's impact on your well-being. Sleep is but one of many factors that impact your quality of life. Other factors are your relationships, your exercise routine, your diet, your mental health. And on top of that is the fact that there's much in life that we just don't control. For instance, to whom and when and where you were born, and what uncontrolled events or unexpected consequences cross your path. So try not to get overly concerned about your sleep. Improved sleep by itself is unlikely to dramatically change your life, but it will help take you in the right direction. I say this only to help you avoid worrying about sleep, as worrying will predictably prevent you from sleeping well. The amount of sleep you need is determined genetically, like your height or your shoe size. When you buy shoes, you judge which shoes to buy by its feel and how it looks. In the same way, you should judge your sleep by how rested and alert you feel the next day. The average shoe size for men is size 9, and I would be crazy to insist on a size 9 shoe when my feet are actually a size 11. In the same way, you should judge your sleep time on how well sleep is working for you, not the average sleep time stated in the media. Next time you hear an alarming headline about how people get less than the average amount of sleep, remember that just as 50% of the population has a shoe size that's smaller than the average, 50% of the population gets less than the average hours of sleep. Unfortunately, some reporters are not well-versed in statistics, and I find it quite amusing but kind of sad when I hear it in the press, knowing that it causes people to unnecessarily worry about their sleep. In fact, some insomnia is caused by people worrying that they don't get the average amount of sleep each night. If this happens to you, remember the shoe size analogy and enjoy a nice chuckle at yourself. In addition, the optimum amount of sleep is probably less than we think, as Dr. Erickson explains.
I think in the context of somebody that has trouble sleeping, I think something that is very, very important to know is that what you typically hear about how much one should sleep is not true. Meaning you always hear that one should sleep about 8 hours or a variation of that. One should sleep between 7 to 9 hours. And I've done a lot of research trying to find out where those numbers come from, and that eludes me. But I can tell you that the 8-hour number has been brought up as a recommendation for hundreds of years. But here's the thing. If you actually ask people that have no trouble sleeping, healthy adults, how much they sleep, most people will say 7 hours. 7 hours is the average answer you'll get from people that have no trouble sleeping. However, when you objectively check those same people that thought they slept 7 hours, when you objectively measure sleep in healthy adults, people sleep about 6 hours and 15 minutes on average, very consistently. Not only is that true here in a Western society, but when people have done studies in pre-industrial societies where there's no artificial not light, where people live hunter-gatherer style, pardon me, they sleep the exact same amount, a little bit more than 6 hours. So it's very important to know that most people sleep a little bit more than 6 hours, but and that is so important to know because that can take off so much pressure. A lot of people feel that they have to reach a certain number, they have to reach 7 or they have to reach 8. Knowing that most people sleep around 6 hours can take a lot of pressure off and really help when you're trying to sleep better.
If that's not enough for you to rest a little easier, keep in mind that people with insomnia typically underestimate the amount of sleep they're getting by about an hour. That's right. When they put people with insomnia in a sleep lab where they can accurately measure the sleep and ask them the next morning, "How much sleep do you think you got?" they typically underestimate the amount of sleep by a full hour. You might be doing the same. Knowing how to tell how you're doing sleep-wise is an important aspect of CBTI, or Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, that we will be using in this course, as you don't aim for a specific time, but rather respond to the body's signals that you need to be sleeping more or sleeping less. In terms of sleep science, I'm going to stick with the minimum you need to execute the techniques in this course successfully. In one of the ironies of life, people who sleep well typically don't know much about sleep because, well, they don't need to. It's we insomniacs that think that becoming sleep experts will somehow cure us of our sleepiness. I would like to explain a few aspects of sleep in more detail that will help you with the course. The first is the two-model process for sleep. Basically, this model sees the sleep-wake phenomena as a tug-of-war between two opposing processes.
On the one hand, in the left corner, from the moment you wake up in the morning, the brain starts a very slow process of pulling the brain towards sleepiness.
As the day goes on, this pressure to sleep goes up and up and up and gets stronger and stronger. By bedtime, the brain is really, really wanting to get some sleep. This is called sleep pressure. Sleep pressure is caused by the buildup of a chemical called adenosine. For CBTI, this is important to know because part of the methodology is to work with your sleep pressure, not against it. Caffeine, for instance, temporarily blocks adenosine from working, which is why it helps to perk you up.
And opposing this pull towards feeling sleepy, in the opposite corner, is another system that is keeping the brain alert and responsive to your environment.
This pull towards alertness grows during the day to counteract the sleepiness pull. The level of alertness is controlled by the circadian rhythm. This is a 24-hour cycle that controls many aspects of your daily life, including thirst and hunger, level alert of alertness, body temperature, and so on. Around bedtime, the sleepiness factor is pulling hard, and around the same time, the brain releases chemicals that shut down the alertness drive and prepare the brain for sleep. During sleep, the sleep drive is gradually reduced, and the next morning, sleep pressure is at its minimum, and the whole process starts up all over again. You don't need to memorize the details. First, be assured that CBTI works with these natural rhythms and does not try to manipulate them or get you to work against them. The second is it means going to bed when your sleep drive is high, not when your clock shows a certain time, is important. Listen to your body, not a digital display. And third, do things that help the brain switch off its alertness so you can sleep. Here's how Michael Schwartz explains it.
And I think it's helpful to understand kind of on the science of, about sleep that, you know, your sleep is kind of dictated by really how long you've been awake that drives your natural sleep, your homeostatic sleepiness. And then there's also that circadian drive, which is kind of a cyclic back and forth of sleep and wake. So they kind of have to be lined up in order for sleep to be its best.
There are a few triggers that inform the brain to cut back on the level of alertness and start sleeping. The first is light. Humans are nocturnal, meaning that you're designed to sleep at night. So when the intensity of light decreases, this is a strong signal to your brain that it should switch over to sleep mode. In the same way, bright light, especially in the morning, is a trigger that alertness should be switched into high gear. Low light levels trigger the release of melatonin, a hormone you have likely heard of whose role is to trigger reduced levels of alertness in the brain. This function of melatonin is important to understand because people often take melatonin to help with their sleep. But the only proven use of melatonin is to help shift when the sleep starts, not the quality or quantity of sleep. So, for example, if you tend to be a night owl and want to get to sleep earlier, then melatonin may help by triggering your sleep a bit earlier. Other than that, clinically, melatonin isn't recommended for insomnia. Another sleep trigger is the level of stimulation from the environment. When you stop stimulating activities, The brain knows it can reduce alertness and let sleep take over. If you maintain stimulating activities right up to bedtime, your brain stays on high alert. Your response to stimulus is highly personalized, as what stimulates you is boring to another. For instance, a good drama movie in the evening makes it hard for me to get to sleep, whereas you might find it relaxing. One way to think of this is that for your ancestors, sleep was a highly vulnerable state. During sleep, we were susceptible to harm from wild animals, snakes, insects, and even from other humans. You have survival instincts that prevent you from sleeping if you feel at risk. So before bedtime, you want to relax and not introduce thoughts or activities that could be perceived as threatening, whatever that might mean for you. This is a core aspect of CBTI, and several of the CBTI, or Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia methods, deal with controlling your level of anxiety. Sleep triggers are important to remember because they direct us what to do and what to avoid in the hour or so before bedtime. Our sleep cycle has evolved over millions of years, and despite amazing progress by humans over the past 80,000 years or so, your DNA remains the same as your ancestors, and thus the sleep process, which is genetic, not cultural, remains unchanged. One of my favorite sayings of my grandmother was that
every generation thinks they're the ones that discovered sex.
In the same way, you can be misled into believing that society's advances somehow make us into different human beings, able to outsmart sleep. But genetically, you're unchanged, and sleep is a DNA-driven phenomena. It's best to work with your sleep processes, not trying to bend a multi-million-year development into our modern self-concept of what you wish was true. Sleep is so embedded into your very being that very, very few people have a broken sleep mechanism. If you're worried that your sleep system is broken, you can safely put that out of your mind. And if you're still convinced it is, see a healthcare provider and have this issue resolved. Otherwise, it may interfere with the success of this course. In a later lesson, I'll talk about different conditions that can affect your sleep and what to do about it. The only brain region I'll be focusing on is the prefrontal cortex. As it implies, this is the front portion of your brain, just right behind your forehead. It controls your ability to plan, analyze, make decisions. In other words, it's the part of the brain that creates anxiety about the future and stress about the past. This is important to know because anxiety and stress prevent you from sleeping well. It's worth noting that while the prefrontal cortex is extremely active during the day as you make your way through the world with all its challenges, if you're sleeping well, it pretty much turns off at night. As an example, during REM or rapid eye movement sleep, the brain is very active, except the prefrontal cortex region. This is probably why dreams can be so wild and free, as the dream is unhindered by the logical, controlling prefrontal cortex. One of the roles of CBTI is to reduce the anxiety in the prefrontal cortex so it doesn't interfere with your sleep. Sleep isn't uniform. It has different sleep stages. And although you don't need to understand the different sleep stages in detail, I want to mention them here so you can understand some experiences you may have with your insomnia. Before getting into the details, I'd like to give you an audio simulation of brain activity during sleep. Brain activity can be measured with an EEG, which measures the electrical activity in your brain. Here is what a simulation of an alert person's brain activity at 22 Hz would sound like. When you're resting, such as when you wind down before going to bed, your EEG would sound more like this at 18 Hz. This is the same frequency that your brain is at during REM or rapid eye movement sleep. As you drift off to sleep, your brain slows down even more into N1 and N2 sleep at 10 hertz. Then, when you get into your deepest N3 sleep at 2 hertz, it would sound like this. So here it is all together in a condensed version of what your brain goes through, starting with alertness, then to being relaxed, then N1 and N2 sleep, then way down to N3 sleep, then popping up into REM sleep, and finally back to waking up and being alert. And now for the technical details. So the three stages of sleep are called N1, N2, and N3, kind of like Dr. Seuss's Cat in the Hat with Thing 1 and Thing 2. After you lay down to sleep, you drift into N1 sleep, the doorway to sleep. This is when you are in between wakefulness and sleep, and normally lasts about 1 to 7 minutes. As we learned previously, you can't enter this stage unless your sleep drive is high, and your alertness level is low. N2 follows N1. It's where you spend most of your sleep, about 50%. It has a low level of brain activity when the brain rejuvenates. N2 usually lasts about 20 minutes in each sleep cycle. N2 is followed by N3. N3 is also known as deep sleep, slow wave sleep, or delta wave sleep. It is the slowest brainwave pattern we listen to. It's the deepest sleep stage, and it's the stage that leaves you feeling rested in the morning. Normally, you get most of your N3 sleep early in the night, so even if you don't sleep well, you probably got a good dose of N3 sleep. It's hardest to wake from this stage, and if you're woken, you will likely feel especially groggy or disoriented. You don't want to get into N3 sleep while napping, or you will wake and feeling groggy rather than rested, and it will make it harder to fall asleep at night because it dips into your sleep pressure and lessens it. We will discuss proper napping techniques in a later lesson. The last stage of sleep is REM or rapid eye movement sleep. At this stage, your brain is active, and it's when you do most of your dreaming. But while your brain is active, the prefrontal cortex is pretty quiet. You do less REM sleeping early in the night and more towards the end of the night. And now I'm going to tell you the most important part about sleep for someone with insomnia. How many times do you think you wake up at night? Does that seem excessive to you? Let's hear what Michael Swartz has to say about nighttime awakenings.
I think it's also important to be able to know that everyone wakes up multiple times every night. That's something, especially if you're, you know, working with someone with insomnia, that's a very helpful message. But just everyone should just be aware that we wake up multiple times, but there's a tremendous amount of amnesia involved with sleep. So we tend really not to remember, 90% of the times that we wake up during the night. And I've seen that extensively as a sleep technologist over the years. I learned that very early on in the 1980s. You ask your patient, how many times do you think you woke up last night? And they woke up about 100 or 150 times. And they say, oh, maybe 4 or 5. And you get a sense very quickly that there's not a lot of the idea, the memory of how much you sleep, how much you wake up is really pretty elusive for everyone.
May no longer be a spring chicken, and so I'd like to say a couple of things about sleep and aging. The first thing to know is that N3 sleep, which again was the slow wave sleep that makes you feel well rested in the morning, goes down with age. It drops by about 2% per year, so that for a healthy person in their 20s, their N3 sleep might take up about 20% of their sleep. By the time you get into your 70s, that could be down into the 2 or 3% region. So it's normal and natural as you age to feel a little less well-rested in the morning. The second thing to know is those nighttime awakenings that Michael Schwartz talked about happen more frequently and they last for longer periods of time as you get older. So whereas a young person might have, say, half a dozen significant awakenings during the night, a person in their 70s might be 20 or 30 times a night where they are fully awake. This is perfectly natural and nothing to be concerned about. I hope you find it reassuring to learn that waking up at night is normal. Nobody sleeps solid through the night, although good sleepers may not remember waking up because it's not important to them, and it's no longer a stress trigger for them as it might be for you. You have these nighttime awakenings for survival. As you learned earlier, sleep was a vulnerable time for our ancestors, so they needed to quickly check on the environment to make sure all was well. If you wake on your own during the night, this is probably when you wake up. After your brief awakenings, when you go back to N1 and through the sleep stages all over again, it takes about 80 to 120 minutes to go through all the stages from N1 to REM sleep. From a CBTI perspective, the main message is that it helps a lot to have your stress or anxiety under control to enter sleep and that waking during the night is normal. In a future lesson, we will cover what to do when you can't get to sleep, either when you go to bed or if you wake in the night and can't get back to sleep. Now you have a basic understanding of sleep. We have covered a lot of information. It will be helpful to review this lesson after you've listened to the other lessons, as it will make a lot more sense then, and you will likely notice information that didn't seem important at the time and you forgot, but it helps you after you've listened to the other lessons. Also, I might have made some improvements since this recording. Show notes, as always, are available at sleepthehealthy.com, and I'd like to finish with some advice from Dr. Erickson.
I want to say the following, that CBTI has been around for decades. It has been shown in study after study after study to be very, very effective. My personal experience is that it's kind of like weight loss, meaning if you exercise more, and if you restrict caloric intake, you will lose weight. I feel it's the same with CBTI. If you apply CBTI techniques, if you understand them, if you commit to them, and if you follow through, you will sleep better. It's pretty much guaranteed, in my opinion. This said, just like weight loss and exercise, it is not easy. It's not easy to get up every time the same day, even if you had a night when you slept very little. It's not easy sometimes to make sure you don't fall asleep during the day. It's not easy to change your mindset to one where you are not trying to sleep, where you're not wanting to sleep. But if you just start working, if you follow through, if you commit, you will sleep better.
Each lesson will have an assignment. You can find the assignments at sleepthehealthy.com. Today's assignment is to start monitoring your sleep with a sleep journal. There are easy and complex ways of doing this. I find the easier approaches work best. There are a few examples on sleepthehealthy.com or search sleep journal on the internet for some sample forms. Your assignment is to find a form you like, print it off, and start using it on a daily basis. This is important for several reasons. First, it sets a baseline you can use to measure progress or if you're plateauing or backsliding. Second, it will help shed light on the cause and effect relationship between daytime activities and nighttime sleep. You should see better what helps and what hinders your sleep. Third, it gives more accurate information about your sleep so you don't make assumptions or think things are worse or better than they really are. And finally, if you ever seek professional help with your sleep, the first thing they are likely to ask about are the facts and details of your sleep. A sleep journal is about the only way you can give them accurate and reliable information. I also recommend journaling in a less formal, more wordy fashion. This means writing or typing your thoughts each day about your sleep, what you noticed, what you think the causes might be, what effects it has on your sleep, and so on. There are samples on my website, sleeptohealthy.com. Many people, including myself, learn a lot by writing about issues rather than trying to sort everything out in my brain. You could try one of the many sleep journal apps for your smartphone. I don't make any recommendations, so you're on your own there. What I don't recommend is a sleep tracking wearable. The purpose of a journal is to gather information so you can see the cause and effect of your behaviors and actions on your sleep, not to track your sleep in charts with performance statistics. I discourage you using a sleep wearable because by measuring your performance, they can easily start to cause stress and anxiety. And stress and anxiety, they're the number one sleep killer. This isn't a race or a contest. As you will learn in the Sleep Buddy lesson, your attitude towards sleep should be more like your attitude towards a good friend. It's not a case of conquering, but of enjoying and appreciating. In the end, do what works for you. But if you find yourself getting anxious because of your sleep performance, or if you find yourself becoming dependent on your sleep wearable, meaning you think you would not sleep well without it, then drop it immediately, regardless of what you paid for it. It has turned into your sleep enemy. Well, that wraps up lesson number 2, where we learned about what sleep is, how it works, and some of the things that interfere with sleeping well, such as stress and anxiety. We learned about what you desire, more and better sleep. In the next lesson, we will learn about the enemy, insomnia. We'll learn that insomnia may not be as bad for you as you thought, how you came to have and perpetuate your insomnia, and learn what you can do to start correcting your sleepless nights.
The thought process that these sleep efforts lead to create more insomnia. So it's really important to understand that anything you do to try to produce sleep always will produce insomnia.
I hope it's obvious, but this podcast is not a substitute for advice from a qualified healthcare professional. The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and entertain. As we do not know your particulars, we cannot possibly provide professional or medical advice. Your use of the information in this podcast is at your own risk. You don't need tons of sleep trivia and people's opinions about sleep. You just need to know proven instructions on what you can do today to sleep better tonight so you can feel and function better tomorrow. This also allows you to repeat lessons as it's hard to absorb all the information the first time through, and the information will make more sense after you've had the context of the whole course. You, like most people, will likely benefit from repeated listening. The lessons will be updated based on student feedback, so the next time you listen to the same lesson, it may be improved since the last time. And that's about it. Thanks for joining me in my sleep class. I look forward to seeing you again on the next episode of the Sleep to Healthy podcast. See you then.